Thanks for joining us on Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here, and it's time to talk about vehicle maintenance with our expert Jim Ward back with us. Jim retired as service manager of Smart Motors Toyota a while back. He was with the company for 36 years. And we're going to talk with him about a lot of things, selecting tires. Maybe we'll start with that for winter driving. We'll also cover checking your battery. And, of course, take your questions. Are you having problems with your vehicle? We'd love to hear from you. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@WPR.org. Jim Ward, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Thanks, Larry. Great to be here.
Tires. Let's start with tires. It's obviously important for safe winter driving. How do you know when it's time to get a new one?
Well, tread depth is typically the key, although age of tires is an important factor as well. You know, there are typically 9 to 10 32nds of an inch of tread on a brand new tire for a passenger car, and you're not going to get to use all of that. typically, the wear limit is considered to be 3 32nds of an inch, and in the middle of summer, without rain and without wet roads, that's okay, but it is absolutely not okay when we have wet roads and a lot of water on the road and icy conditions and snow. It's simply not enough traction. So this is the time of year that you want to make sure that you know 3 32nds of an inch is totally insufficient. And you got to realize that if you're at 5, you might be okay at the start of winter. But if you know by the end of winter, you're going to end up replacing your tires before winter is out. And tire manufacturers gear up for that in a big, big way. You know, I recall several years where after a certain point, not very far into winter, we couldn't get a lot of size of snow tires anymore or some of the more aggressive treads of regular all-season tires that you might want to get. So now is the time to think about it. Get your tires checked out. If they are getting down in that range of 3 to 5 32nds of an inch, get some different tires. And the kind of tires that you buy are going to depend a little bit on the kind of driving you have to do. I live way out in the country, drive some quite rural roads that get to see some beautiful agricultural fields on the way to work and back when I was commuting, but those roads were also subject to a lot of snow and drifting. And for my driving, snow tires or a four-wheel drive vehicle was really important. If you live in town or if your schedule is such that you're going to be on the road after the plows have been out, and you know you're primarily in town on plowed roads and good conditions and not prone to drifting, then you probably don't need a snow tire, a dedicated snow tire. Just good enough tread, with thick enough tread over 5 32nds of an inch to get you through the winter.
Yeah. So isn't it, there was a trick, I think you told me this one other time about, was it a penny?
The penny has been the thing they've used for years, that you put it in there upside down, and if you can see the top of Lincoln's head, then your tires were out. Now they say, because they don't want people to run their tires down to that legal bare limit, now the quarter is the new penny for that, they say. But there are tire tread gauges, and basically every tire will have what are called wear bars. If you look in the grooves of the tread, about every foot or so around the tire, there's kind of like a little bar down in that groove of the tread all the way across each one of them that represents where the lowest point is. But again, I got to emphasize, you don't want to be anywhere near that this time of year going into winter.
Okay. So what's the difference primarily between an all-season tire and a winter tire?
Well, a snow tire, something that's actually able to be called a snow tire, it's manufactured different. It's tested to different specifications in terms of what is expected for traction, they have a symbol. It looks like a little mountaintop with a snowflake on it that's on a tire that is actually tested and certified to be a snow tire. And anything else that's called all-season or all-terrain is not necessarily a snow tire. That rubber is a different compound. It's got advantages in the cold weather, and it's got disadvantages in warm weather, in as much as you don't want to leave those snow tires on all summer, because that type of rubber is prone to wear pretty quickly if the temperature is over 50 degrees. So they're definitely for winter use, but they have superior traction in snow and winter and cold conditions.
So somebody is asking here, what is tire rot?
Well, that tire rod is that's the other thing I had mentioned earlier about tires. We primarily talk about tread depth when we're talking about tires, but most manufacturers, all tires will have a manufacturer date on it. It'll have the week of the year in a number and then the year that it was made. And most manufacturers recommend you replace those tires by 5 or 6 years. Increasingly, so many people I know increasingly work from home, don't drive their cars as much as they used to, and may very well have really good tread depth left on those tires at 5 or 6 years. But the tire is especially something from exposure to sun and UV rays that the rubber breaks down, and you can start to see cracking in the sidewalls. And even if you don't see that cracking in the sidewalls, that continual exposure causes a deterioration of the rubber, and the tires basically can age out. People don't primarily, in my experience, replace tires due to age if the tread is really good. But, it's something you should consider, especially if you do see any weather cracking, we call it, in the sidewalls.
Yeah. Should you get all four tires? Should you replace all four tires, or is it okay just to get away with two?
Well, increasingly, people are driving all-wheel drive cars and cars that have all-wheel drive systems. They're not real friendly to having a great difference in tread depth. Most all-wheel drive systems are going to want all your tires to be within 3/32 of an inch. So if you've got some tires that are at 6 and the new ones are at 10, that's too far apart. It'll mess up the differentials and the transfer cases in some all-wheel drive and four-wheel drive vehicles to have that different diameter of tires. It's different by manufacturer. Over my years of experience, some manufacturers, vehicles were far more sensitive to that than others, but it's something you don't want to find out the hard way. So, if it's just a front-wheel drive or rear-wheel drive vehicle, you could get away with just replacing two tires most of the time. If it's not, then you really have to pay attention to what the difference is going to be between the thinnest tread tire on the vehicle and the thickest.
And, of course, in the wintertime or the cold weather time, the it's often that the low tire pressure dash light comes on.
Yep, it's this time of year that shops start to see a parade in the morning when the temperature drops overnight. It's kind of a natural thing that some tires are just going to lose some air due to that great temperature drop. It isn't something that necessarily happens every night, but if you have a few nights where it suddenly drops over 10 degrees overnight, that can create that situation. It doesn't necessarily mean that there's a leak that should be fixed, although that is something that, if you continually have this day after day, you probably have a leak, a puncture, or something that needs to be repaired. Nitrogen in tires is something else that has been touted for a lot of benefits. Some of those benefits are pretty marginal, but one thing we did, I always notice consistently, is that when nitrogen are in tires, they are less prone to that cold weather, cold overnight temperature drop, air loss.
I'm on Facebook and other places, I see a lot of ads essentially for these portable units that will blow up a low tire. So you can have it in your trunk, let's say, and your tire is low. You can just pull that out and not have to run to a gas station.
I've got one that runs off my lighter. They're the slickest thing. I keep it in my vehicle. That and a portable jump pack, just a little lithium battery jump pack that you want to keep charged and keep in the vehicle. In the winter, of course, you want to have a cell phone in the car, but your cell phone could be dying. If you have your cord, you can charge it too, usually off these little lithium jump packs. Those are two things that, and they've gotten to where they're really small. My little air pump that runs off of a power jack, or what we used to call a lighter jack in the vehicle, it is tiny. I mean, it is, the size of a book. It's not very big at all. And the jump pack that I use also is not very big. The two of them combined are smaller than a loaf of bread.
It's amazing. Is there a particular brand that's better than one, better than another?
I couldn't recommend a specific brand. The jump packs, the lithium ones are the way to go because they're able to be much smaller. They hold their charge longer. With the air pump, again, I couldn't recommend a particular brand. If you have one, they all work about the same.
Yeah, and those lithium jump packs, I mean, it's Most of them are set up so that you can't screw it up when you go to attach.
That's right. That's right. Even if you, well, I don't know that everyone's the same, but mine certainly will tell you if you've got the cables connected wrong on the battery rather than cause an expensive mistake or, you know, shorting something out. It simply won't function because it senses that. So, yeah, they're smart. And, you know, really, I think mine has been used more like when we were camping to charge a cell phone than I've ever had to use it. Although, you know, I had a weird experience. Batteries almost always fail in a very predictable manner. Batteries last about 3 to 5 years. But over the course of my whole career, only about a handful of times, I saw a weird battery problem. There's something internally wrong in the battery. It shorts out, and intermittently, the vehicle won't start. And I had that in my vehicle this summer. I tested the battery 4 or 5 different times, tested good every time. And then there was a bulletin on various types of connection issues, cable connection issues, and a ground bolt problem. There were like 5 different bulletins that could cause that kind of symptom, you know, and it would be very frustrating if I was a consumer. I was paying someone else to go through and check out those bulletins and make sure those were all right. I went through all of those on my own vehicle. You know, I found one of them that was loose, but none of them was a problem. Ultimately, it eventually did turn out to be the battery. But fortunately, batteries almost always will, on a test that a shop can do, even if your battery is not acting up, causing a problem, can tell you its potential life, that this battery is likely to fail soon. Unfortunately, again, there's that odd, very odd, occasional type of battery failure like I had this year that is just a frustrating one because it'll act up once and it won't act up again for a month maybe, and then you'll take it and have it tested. The battery will test good. Most people aren't going to run into that, but it just, it is a good idea to have it tested this year. And again, if you've not been having problems and they tell you and show you a strip that says, a little test strip that says your battery's potential life going forward is very low, go ahead and get it replaced. Don't try to get that last couple of starts out of it or last month out of it or something and then end up stranded somewhere in the cold.
Yeah, absolutely. And I understand that the cost of batteries has increased a bit over the last year or two.
It has. It seems about like everything else. You know, batteries are heavy by and large, and they have to be shipped, and shipping of anything has become significantly more expensive, so that's a factor in it. AGM batteries or glass mat batteries are getting more and more common. They have some advantages. They tend to be a little more powerful. They hold their charge longer, but they are also more expensive, and they're being recommended more often. They're the battery that's going to be in a hybrid electrical vehicle that has the 12-volt battery inside the cabin because they don't outgas. So they are a more expensive battery, and they are becoming more and more common on the market and more typically recommended to be a replacement.
And an AGM, I mean, what? How's it different from the standard?
Well, it's a sealed battery. The chemicals are held in what's called a glass mat, in a mat inside of the battery, rather than being like a gelled or a liquid filled battery. They're sealed. There's no danger of them leaking. They were made originally. They were designed originally for aircraft application. I mean, they could be set in a vehicle sideways. They tend to charge up about 5 times faster and easier than a regular battery. They hold their charge longer. There are a few cons. They're more sensitive to overcharging, but by and large, you know, all of the advantages are greater, but they do tend to be a bit more expensive. So, it's just a decision you have to make. You know, increasingly, I saw an ad recently of a shop that it wasn't a local shop, but it might have been in California, but a woman owns a shop. She runs a shop, and she says she recommends batteries for customers every 3 years. And she said, you know, women, and this isn't just a gender thing, it's anybody that drives wants security in their vehicle, but what they want to buy when they want a battery is security and safety and dependability and not long life necessarily. Long life is great, but batteries are unpredictable. And again, 3 to 5 years is it. So, you know, this shop recommends every 3 years and got some pushback from some people. It says, you know what, this is the way that I can most ensure that you're not going to have a problem. You know, you're not going to be stranded somewhere. So I don't necessarily say that that's a recommendation I would make. I think, take your vehicle in every 6 months, have the battery tested, and find out, what its potential is going forward. But it is a subject that people, what are you shopping for? Are you shopping, as opposed to just shopping for a battery, it's putting it in the perspective of shopping for security.
Our guest today, Jim Ward, retired service manager of Smart Motors Toyota of Madison. Great to have him back with us. And, you know, we've been talking tires, we've been talking batteries. We'll take other questions certainly as well. So what's going on with your vehicle? Or a question about batteries or tires or anything else for that matter in the auto area, give us a call. The number, 800-642-1234, or you could email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Taking a look at your automobile today and maintenance of it with our guest, Jim Ward, retired as service manager of Smart Motors Toyota, was with the company for 36 years and does a great job answering auto questions. Again, the number is 800-642-1234. Email to talk@WPR.org. Kathy emailed, one of her front brakes dust shields rusted and came off of her 2005 Toyota Camry. Her mechanic said without the shield, rain and snow can get to the brakes, reducing their efficiency. To replace the brake shield means a wheel bearing job. The cost estimate is high, slightly over $1,000. Is this repair worth doing?
Well, I don't know the condition of the car. The concern is not snow and ice getting in there. Snow and ice will get in there regardless. That's not why the dust shield is there. The dust shield is to keep bigger chunks of you know, pebbles and rocks and stuff from getting in there easily. And unfortunately, that, in an ideal world, if you lived in Arizona and the car had been in Arizona its whole life, you would not be looking at that bigger repair. You'd be looking at just replacing that dust shield. It's a type of metal. It's not much thicker than a cookie sheet. It's just shaped and round. And but the problem is rust, and rust is what causes that to become so seized to the hub that your wheel bearing is in that you can't replace it if it's lived its life in a salt state like Wisconsin. You can't replace it without replacing that whole hub. An 05 Camry, you know, depending on the condition of the car, I would probably take that car and have an overall inspection done on it before I would invest that money for that repair, just to make sure that there's not something else creeping out there that you're going to replace the right front one and find out that something in the left rear, you know, needs to be done, and you have a bunch of other expenses. So I would evaluate that vehicle. You know, it probably is worth putting it into, depending on the results of that inspection. You know, if you find out that it needs five or six things that are each going to be $500 to $1,000, that changes the equation entirely.
Yeah, for sure. Let's go to Bayfield County. Bill from the town of Barnes, one of my old stopping grounds. Bill, hi. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Hey. Thank you, Larry. Well, let me know when you're here this summer. We'll get together. Oh. I appreciate you coming up. This was actually an RV pulling a trailer, but I think it applies to cars as well. A blowout, and I may have had a puncture that occurred a few miles before that. Not sure about that. My question is, would a tire pressure monitoring system have given me enough warning that I was losing air to get off the road? As it was, I had a blowout. You know, it's laminated and block the side of the RV a little bit. I'd like to avoid that, but invest in it if it would help. But, you know, is that going to save me from that delamination in the event of a puncture?
Well, it ultimately, a tire pressure warning system would have warned you that tire was getting low, and that is something you definitely want to have. You know, I pull a travel trailer, and I bought a kit that basically our tire pressure sensors, that there are different type of tire pressures, air pressure sensors for tires. This type, I didn't have to pull the valve core out. It just goes on the end of the valve core, and then it's got a signal back to a little unit that's on the dash, and that's actually even solar powered. It's all pretty wireless, you know, and it pretty instantaneously tells you when a tire starts to lose air, and, you know, and that hopefully would give you just enough time to get pulled over. It's not like you're probably going to make it to the next exit, but that is such a scary and dangerous situation when you're pulling any kind of a trailer or camper or anything like that, to have a tire go down and have a blowout. I mean, it can... Yeah, so the results can just be, you know, terrible. But yeah, that's definitely the key, is to have a tire pressure warning system. I don't, you know, my travel trailer was a 2016. It didn't come with it. And I don't know that a lot of them do, but they're not really expensive. They're out there. I highly recommend it.
Yeah, there you go, Bill. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. John in Appleton, we'll give you a chance to join in. Hi, John.
Yeah, good morning, Larry, and thank you, guests, for all you do. I'm up here in Appleton, and you know, the state announced a whole bunch of laws, and the feds announced a whole bunch.
Oh.
But you know.
Electric charging stations you were talking about, John?
Does the guest know anything about when the rollout will be happening with these electric charging stations for cars?
Yeah. Okay, so John's wondering about electric charging stations that are going to be rolled out around the state. And, you know, I can't tell. I honestly don't know the timeline on that. Do you know the timeline at all, Jim?
I don't. You know, there are a number of different things that are involved. Sometimes individuals will, you know, I know someone who actually paid for and had about 8 electric vehicle charging stations installed along the interstate in Iowa. You know, just an individual that did that. You know, and of course, there are a number of different programs to try to get as many as out there, and of course there are an insufficient number of them. If anyone who's tried to travel across the country, even across the state, in an all-electric vehicle using, will tell you about the frustrations of, you know, you just have to be patient and have time to wait. But I do not know anything about what the scheduling is going to be, when there's going to be a sufficient network out there to make that kind of vehicle use more practical and efficient.
Yeah, I'm sorry we don't have information. Maybe somebody listening does and can call in and let us know what they've heard. John, stay listening. Stacy emailed us. She wants you to talk, Jim, about parasitic drains. She is from Arizona, where winter driving is not really an issue. Can you walk her through the steps she should take before driving in winter conditions, like warming up the engine, de-icing the windshield, you know, all that sort of thing?
Sure. The term parasitic drain, I don't know if there was a specific problem we were talking about. All batteries have a certain amount of power being drawn from them when the vehicle's off, just to run computers and to run various things. For most vehicles, that should be below 25 to 30 milliamps, and if it's, you know, there's a test they can run. If it's more than that, then they need to start diagnosing. In terms of coming from a non-winter state to Wisconsin, you know, clearly some of the basic things that we've talked about, you know, in terms of having, you know, your tires checked, having the battery tested and make sure that it's good, you know, making sure that all your lights work, because visibility is so critical, you know, it in the darkness when we have sketchy roads anyway. Windshield wipers are really critical, because you just cannot believe what's going to be thrown at you if you're not, you know, just navigating the roads. If you're not from a winter climate, driving on them is challenging enough, and all of a sudden there's, you know, a 5-gallon bucket of slush thrown across your windshield, you know, as you drive down the road. So those are some really important things to be aware of. You know, most modern vehicles, warming them up, unless it's 40 below, you don't need to do much warming up of the vehicle, although you may have heat from your heater more immediately, you know, when you start driving if you've warmed it up first. But as far as the engines and the systems on the vehicle are concerned, they're designed to warm up while they're being driven. Start it and go is kind of the idea. Very, very minimal warm-up is necessary. But I would say that the most important thing for someone who hasn't driven in a snow climate is, if you possibly can, try to get somewhere, an open parking lot, somewhere after we've had some snow, and at low speed, just sort of experiment around with acceleration, braking, turning, you know, not even getting aggressive or crazy about it, just to get a feel. Because the vehicles handle, you know, very, very differently. And if you grew up with this, you don't even think twice about it. But if you didn't grow up with it, it's a whole different world to drive on ice and snow. And it takes some getting used to, and there's nothing better than a little practice. That's probably the most important thing you could do.
And it might not hurt for this first year to have snow tires.
You know, it might not, depending on where you have to drive. You know, certainly if you're out in the country, if you're having to drive, roads are going to be subject to snow drifting. I would highly recommend it. You know, it may give you that little added traction, which would give you the added confidence. You know, again, if you grow up in Wisconsin, having a little bit of a skid, having a little sliding, you kind of get used to it and take it in stride. But if you're not used to that, if you didn't grow up driving that way, didn't learn to drive that way, it's kind of shocking, scary, and unfortunately, it can often cause an overreaction. You brake too hard, you turn too much, and lose control of the vehicle. So it staying calm, you know, thinking of the idea of having, you know, on ice, having a egg underneath the gas pedal and the brake, you know, be gentle, you don't want to break that egg kind of thing, are really important. It is easy to say that, but it's not very easy to do it when you're in a sudden situation, you know, a sudden some unexpected slide or skid or spin of tires. So, you know, there's just nothing like getting a little bit of experience out in it when you're not in traffic, and you just get a chance to kind of get a feel for how your vehicle acts on slippy surfaces.
Yeah. And you know what? I've got a blanket in my vehicle. I've got some hand warmers in my vehicle.
Oh, yeah. Yep. The winter safety kit, definitely very important. Those hand warmers are a great thing. You want to have a pile of those. You know, some kind of food is a good idea to have in there. A little difficult to keep water in your vehicle in the wintertime because it's probably going to freeze. But, you know, it is important to have a safety kit with you know, you want to consider something that's got some flares or some, you know, flares mm-hmm. that used to be something that you'd light like a firework, but anymore they're almost always electronic and far easier to set up and use, so you could be seen. But yep, a safety kit is something very important to consider as well, because so we hate to think about being stranded, but it happens, and your comfort and safety can be all the difference in the world by having that safety kit.
Chuck in Appleton, your turn. Hi, Chuck.
Yes, I have a 2016 Ford pickup with a larger EcoBoost. It's got about 124,000 miles. I was just wondering, what kind of routine maintenance would you suggest, like plugs or change the radiator fluid, that type of stuff?
I would go right by Ford's manufacturer recommendations for maintenance. They've got a chart that's going to tell you the mileage or time. It's going to be, you know, time and mileage based, so whichever comes first. You know, on most vehicles, things like antifreeze replacement is now more like a 10-year, 100,000 mile. But, you know, in manufacturers, their recommendations are far more similar than different for each of those things, for spark plugs. But it's a little bit different. So I would just look up Ford, look up your vehicle. You can, you know, if you bought it new, you would have gotten a booklet that had that schedule in it. It's very rare that you need to do more maintenance than what's going to be in that. More maintenance may be recommended sometimes in some parts of the country and at some shops, and if it is, they should be able to give you a very good reason why that would be recommended as opposed to the manufacturer's recommendations, but that is the guide that you want to use.
All right. There you go, Chuck. Thank you. Bruce in Barron County, your turn. Hi, Bruce.
Yes, we live on a main road, and I've noticed the last few years that vehicles make a lot of different noises, and especially pickup trucks. Is that related to tires or vehicle? In some cases, the semis that go by are quieter than what the pickup trucks are.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Well, tires can certainly make a lot of noise. I mean, they're, you know, at first I thought, sure, you were going to be talking about hybrid vehicles, but hybrid vehicles and electric vehicles tend to have all kinds of different sounds that they make. But I think what Bruce is talking about here is just the sound that a vehicle makes at highway speed or going down the road. Tires can make a huge difference. The county highway I live off of got repaved this last year. I think the last time it was done is in the 60s. It's kind of amazing to us because we live in one of those little areas by a valley where there's by some bluffs, and you know, there's a lot of echo. Motorcycles just love to open it up in this little area. But one of the biggest things we noticed after the road was paved is that when we hear a vehicle coming, we hear the tire noise on that new pavement because there isn't all the cracks and expansion cracks to break up that noise. But yeah, you know, I'm not sure what you may be hearing, but you know, trucks tend to have more aggressive tread and more aggressive tires most of the time, so they do make more of a noise. And I think that's primarily what you're talking about here. But it's kind of amazing the difference that some tires can make. And as tires, not necessarily get worn out, but tires can get a cupping to the tread that can make them really noisy. And it's funny, living out here in the country and with this newly paved road, sometimes we can hear a pickup or any vehicle that's got a cupped or a, you know, odd worn tire from a mile away. You just hear that buzz coming. So I think that's what Bruce is talking about there, is just tire noise. I mean, that, you know, they're...
Yeah. I agree. There's just outside of Madison, there's a road that was repaved, a section of it. And it didn't dawn on me. I was driving over it, and I was turning up my radio every time because,
sure.
And then realized when I hit the older part, I had to turn the radio back down. So.
Yep. And sometimes on some highways, some of the things they do with maintenance anymore is to, it's kind of a, rather than repave the road, they'll go down the road with a machine that makes grooves in the road, and those will make a humming sound. In fact, it's somewhere, I think it might have been in Finland, somewhere in the Scandinavian country, they designed a road somewhere that when they did that, it actually would make like musical notes as you drove down the road by changing the distance between those treads. But tires make some interesting sounds, and sometimes it can be a sign of a problem too. So if you are suddenly noticing that your vehicle has got a tire noise or a road noise going down the road it didn't used to have, I'd recommend having your tires looked at just to make sure that you don't have one that's got some tread separating or a cupping or, you know, something that's going to lead to a earlier tire failure.
Dave and Nina, we'll give you a chance now. Hi, Dave.
Yeah, I was calling just to respond to about the caller who talked about winter driving in Wisconsin, to remind people that as a guy that grew up with rear-wheel drive cars, certainly going to front-wheel drive cars dramatically changes the way that you handle and drive in the winter on slippery roads.
It sure does. You know, I grew up primarily as a kid driving rear-wheel drive vehicles. My general feeling and impression is that front-wheel drive vehicles are an advantage, but the most important thing is that they handle very differently. That's why the recommendation of try to get out in the parking lot where you're not around other cars, you're not in traffic, and it just, whether you have a front-wheel drive car or a rear-wheel drive car, find out how it responds and how that feels to you and how you can react.
Yeah, good point, Dave. Thank you very much for calling. John in Spooner, it's your turn. Hi, John.
Hi, guys. Hey, I got, I don't know if you're ready for an old school question, but I got my daily driver is a 1999 Yukon Denali. Came up from Arizona, has no rust. It's a beautiful truck. Engine runs like new, but it wanders. You always have to be compensating for steering on it. I had my mechanic look at it. He put a new steering gear in it, didn't change anything. The tire, I've had it for 2 years now. And the tires show very little wear, and they're wearing evenly. So I don't think it needs an alignment. What would cause it to constantly?
Yeah, be wandering. So you've got to be constantly kind of adjusting your steering wheel.
Hmm. Yeah, I remember driving cross country with a brother-in-law in his Ford pickup years ago, and had that problem where it would just wander back and forth through the lane, and we were having to rush to a family wedding. We were last minute traveling, and I remember just thinking to myself, God, I'm glad this is doing this, because I'm afraid I'd fall asleep driving this thing if I didn't have to constantly pay attention to that. But that can be really annoying, and ultimately the front end, the front suspension and steering mechanisms have a number of different, you've got control arms, bushings for them, stabilizer arms, that all of that could cause free play, and any of that could cause some wandering in the steering. The fact that your tires are wearing evenly, that is an indication that your alignment is likely fine. It doesn't sound like an alignment issue, although not all alignment issues cause tire wear either. So you don't necessarily have to have an alignment done. A lot of shops have equipment. At Smart, when I worked there, we had equipment when you drove through the door, lasers, this laser setup would check the basic alignment of your vehicle and could tell you if it needed to be aligned. You know, that was something done on every single vehicle. So you may consider doing that because there are some alignment, you know, there's two or three different angles that are being adjusted. Two of them will cause tire wear, one of them won't, that could be related to your issue. But I have a feeling that this is something more likely to do with some control arm bushings or stabilizer bushings or something that are worn that are not necessarily affecting tire wear, but you're obviously getting this steering wander that can get pretty annoying.
Yeah, it can. John, thank you. Good luck with that. Check it out. Appreciate your call. And you can join in, too. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or email to talk@wpr.org. If you phone, we'll get you on pretty quickly. Jeff emailed his 2020 F-150 truck hesitates when restarting after stopping to refuel when they are towing their trailer. If they disconnect the trailer prior to, you know, shutting it off, it doesn't hesitate. The alternator and the battery have tested out fine. What could be the problem there?
Well, that description sounds to me like we probably have some ground connection problem somewhere that isn't as secure as it should be somewhere in that trailer wiring that is likely affecting this. That is an odd one. That is really an odd one. But I just cannot imagine how it could be related to anything else. Depending on the trailer you have, you probably have a 7-pin connector for the trailer. There are also 4-pin type connectors for some trailers. But that wiring should be tested just to find out if there's the correct continuity across all the circuits. Something there is not getting a good connection, probably a ground connection that's causing that hesitation, I would bet.
Yeah, it sounds like it. Annie in La Crosse, we'll go to you. Hi, Annie.
Hi. Say, I have a problem with my tires, and I've never heard of it before. It's called weather checking. And I've been driving for, 60-some-odd years and in Wisconsin and the weathers and everything, and I've never heard of that. And my tires are otherwise in good shape. They're 4 years old. And at my garage, they said, oh, you should replace them. And then I went to the actual dealership of the tires, and the guy said, these aren't that bad. So can you tell me what weather checking is, why it is, and how concerned I should be?
Sure. Weather checking is little cracks that you can see primarily on the sidewall of the tire. It's caused by exposure to ultraviolet from the sun. It's not that uncommon, but on 4-year-old tires, that kind of surprises me. I recall a customer having some BF Goodrich tires a few years ago when I was still working that were about that age and had some weather checking. And, you know, we contacted the manufacturer. We contacted BF Goodrich, and it took a couple of calls and some going back and forth, but ultimately they warrantied and covered those tires. Now, the catch here is that you went to the manufacturer, and the guys that looked at it there said, oh, this isn't that bad, but it's there. And on a 4-year-old tire, I don't know that it should be there. So I would be inclined to go back to them and have them either take pictures and document it and ask them, you know, I appreciate your opinion, but I would really also appreciate it if you would contact your rep, contact the manufacturer, and see if they'll consider replacing these for this weather checking. This is something that has, it varies, of course, across the country, depending on where you are. Much bigger problem in Arizona than it is in Wisconsin. But ultraviolet exposure and ultraviolet rays from the sun are something that we are more exposed to, that is more powerful now than it was in the past, and it's going to continue to increase. So this is something that's going to be more and more common. But at tires that are simply 4 years old, if these cracks are visibly noticed and you can see them on the sidewall, I would like to get the manufacturer's opinion, not just some guy that works at the manufacturer's shop, but the manufacturer's opinion about whether that should be happening and what they do about it.
Yeah, Annie, there you go. Thank you for calling. Jim Ward, our guest today, retired as service manager of Smart Motors Toyota of Madison with the company for 36 years. He's been doing this show with us for a long time, and it's always great to have him with us. You can join in, 800-642-1234, email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. We're taking a look at your vehicle on the show today with our guest, Jim Ward, who's been with us a long time doing auto repair and maintenance, answering those questions for our listeners. It's great to have him back. He's retired as service manager of Smart Motors Toyota, and love to have him come by. Just a quick mention, tomorrow on Garden Talk, we'll focus on the history of orchids and beans, and you'll hear growing strategies and a few recipes as well. That's tomorrow at 11 on Garden Talk. Tim emailed us. He's looking at either a Toyota RAV4 or a Highlander and wondering about electric versus hybrid in terms of maintenance and repair.
Well, you know, the vehicle, other than the hybrid or electric systems, the rest of the vehicle maintenance is pretty similar. Still, obviously, has tires and wipers and lights and wheel bearings and things like that. You know, in the time that I was still working, the electric vehicles that we had on the road, I don't honestly really ever recall one repair, not one warranty claim related to the electric charging systems. And on hybrid vehicles, you know, it wasn't very common to have repairs on those either. You know, part of your concern with an electric vehicle, though, is going to be, again, the kind of driving that you do in those charging stations. You know, so that's going to be an important part of your consideration, where you have to go and what availability is going to be to charge it.
Yeah, and for this is a personal comment of my own. I have the Highlander, and a good friend has my Highlander's like 10 years old, and my good friend's RAV4 is like a half a year old. And mine rides a lot better. That Highlander, you get a more comfortable ride in the Highlander than you do in the RAV4. So if you're doing a lot of traveling, that Highlander rides a whole lot better, I think.
Yeah. It is considered, you know, the higher next tier level up of vehicles, so that you would expect that. You know, there we had a call about hybrid. But electrical vehicle charging stations in Wisconsin. And during that news break, I just took a quick look. There's a great Wisconsin Public Radio article from May of 2024 about a big Department of Transportation awarded $23.3 million in Wisconsin to do some construction. And basically, some of the recipients were 24 Quick Trip stores, the Oneida Casino, Pottawatomie Fireside Market, all got them, a number of different gas station chains. And they're basically looking along the Wisconsin, what they call the alternative fuel corridor. But anyway, anyone that's got questions about that, I would recommend just looking up that WPR article. It's got great information about what's going to be happening with charging stations in the state.
Yeah, I should have remembered that myself. And Tom in Marquette, Michigan may have something to add about charging stations. Tom?
Yes, your earlier caller had that question, so I thought I'd let you know. I came across an interesting website. It's afdc.energy.gov/fuels/electricity-locations. That's kind of a long URL, but I think if you even just looked up EV charging stations near me, that would probably pop up on most search engines. And it's pretty surprising how many are shown countrywide for EV charging. But just a word of caution is that it's good to check ahead of time. And most of the stations, if you just tap on the station that's shown, it will let you know what the hours are and if it's available. And it would even make sense to call ahead, because my experience with some of those is that they are not very reliable. And that would be all information really for non-Tesla vehicles. Tesla has their own charging system. It's a proprietary system that a few other vehicles have some access to now. But in general, for EV charging, that map, I think, would be real helpful for anyone who is planning a trip right now.
Yeah.
Sure. Great information.
Tom, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Dave in Appleton, your turn. Hi, Dave.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I hope I can ask three questions. One of them is, when I change my oil, if I change it for synthetic oil, that's I can drive three times farther than I can regular oil, but it's the same filter. Why do they change your filter so often with regular oil, and is there a difference? The other thing is, I know you touched on it a little bit, if you could go over it again. When it gets 30 or 25 degrees out, I want to start my car remotely. It runs 15 minutes generally, automatically, and I might do that every day. Does that hurt the car? And please, my last question is, I bought a car that was 6 years old with 8,000 miles on. I know the mileage is real. I bought it from a dealer. I checked it all out, and all the maintenance was taken care of for that length of time. Is that car the same as if it were just to be a year old, since you put 10,000-15,000 miles on a year?
Okay.
Interesting question, Dave. I wanted to clarify the question with synthetic oil. Normally, typically, regardless of whether you use synthetic oil or conventional oil, when you get an oil change, the filter is typically done every time. And maybe I misunderstood, but it sounded like you were saying with synthetic oil that you would not change the filter every time.
Yeah, I think
You change. No, you change it every time, but it's twice the miles as a regular oil change.
Oh, sure. Whether the filter
capacity. How can that filter last that long? Yeah.
Well, there certainly is a difference in oil filters. I mean, you can buy generic filters, and you could Google this, and there's a guy that's taken time to take the oil filters apart and show you how much filtering material there is in different oil filters. Manufacturers, regardless of your vehicle manufacturer who recommends synthetic oil, typically their own manufactured brand oil filter is going to be pretty impressive by how much filter material there is in it. And it is designed for the oil change interval that's recommended for the vehicle. But certainly if you just buy generic, filter out there, you might get something that's got much lesser quality filtering, and that is a very important factor. The other thing that I would emphasize is that if you do drive the longer distances that they say you can go with synthetic oil, you want to be getting in the habit of checking or having your oil level checked, because it's not unusual for a car, especially when they get to some higher mileage, to start consuming some oil. It doesn't mean there's necessarily anything wrong with the motor, but if you're going to drive 10,000 miles on oil, or some manufacturers even say 15,000, you want to make darn sure that you're not driving 2 quarts slow on oil and doing some potential engine damage toward the end of that range. So you want to have a good quality filter, and if you're going to drive the longer mileage that you could drive with synthetic oil, get in the habit of having the oil level checked. In regard to the remote start, the vehicles are designed. I don't know that it hurts the vehicle. I would not say it hurts the vehicle to use a remote start and have it run for 15 minutes. It's less efficient. We're using more gas that way. It's not. I always look at the big picture. If everybody does it, how much difference does it really make? It can make a lot of difference if everybody does it. But comfort is important. We live in Wisconsin, and I don't feel the same way about 25, 30 degrees or 25, 30 below now in my mid-60s that I did in my mid-30s, I'll tell you what. So that remote start can be quite a comfort. And then lastly, you talked about a vehicle that was 6 years old and 8,000 miles. And I think vehicles like that are going to be on the market more and more. As we were mentioned earlier, more and more people are working remotely and not driving their vehicles as much. Many things on that vehicle would be similar to just like a one-year-old vehicle. But like a call we had earlier, the tires, those tires are probably going to be more prone to weather checking and needing to be replaced for age rather than tread depth sooner in a situation like that. There are some other systems in the car that are similar that are going to age out as opposed to the miles that are on it, which is part of the reason manufacturers for their maintenance schedules have a time and a mileage interval, and they recommend whichever comes first. And I would still go by that even if you buy a vehicle with really low miles like that. But
yeah, makes a lot of sense. Jim Ward will be with us right up until 12:30 today. We're going to take a quick look at the news, and then we'll be back with Jim Ward. Thank you for being with us, and stay with us here on WPR News. taking a look at your automobile today on the show and what may or may not be wrong with it with our guest Jim Ward, retired service manager of Smart Motors Toyota, and many, many years of service in with cars. The phone lines are full, so let's go right to the phones and to Rick in Wausau. Rick, thank you for calling. What can we do for you?
Hello, gentlemen. Thanks for having me on. I have a 1994 GMC Sonoma pickup truck. It has about 84,000 miles on it. And a couple of weeks ago, I was driving at night with my headlights on, and all of a sudden, the headlights went off. The side marker lights and the dashboard lights stayed on. I was slowing down immediately, and then all of a sudden, they popped back on. Drove probably another 3 or 4 miles down the road, and they popped off again. Slowed down again to pull off, and they popped back on. So just wondering if you had experience with this and what would be the remedy. I do my own work. Obviously, I haven't driven the car since then at nighttime, only during the day. Thank you.
I have not had experience with that specific vehicle, although I do I know I've, you know, we obviously worked on all kinds of vehicles this month besides just the Toyotas. But you probably have a bad ground somewhere. You may have a connection somewhere on a vehicle that age causes you to have, you know, what a terrifying thing to have happen. But essentially, because it's intermittent, it's not going to be the easiest thing to find. But the thing I would do if you're doing your own testing is to just start walking through connections from relays, switches, just checking the connections through the system. You may have a component that's got an internal failure that you're not going to be able to duplicate by just checking connections, but you're a little limited on what you can do with an intermittent problem like that when it's not acting up. So that's where you got to start, is by just checking connections point by point to try to see if there's something loose that's not making a good connection and potentially causing this. What a scary problem to have.
Really scary. Rick, good luck with that. Thank you for calling. Another Rick in Minocqua this time. Hi, Rick.
Hey, Larry. Hey, Jim. So I've got to say, Larry and Jim, Larry, you get a lot of really good experts on the show, but I'd say Jim rates right up there with the best. The experience and the common sense that he brings is really a treasure. It's a pleasure to listen. My question is, Jim, could you make a comment on picking an independent mechanic shop out there? There's a lot of them. The further you get away from Madison and the big cities, the more likely you are to encounter independent mechanic shops, and it's hard to tell who knows what they're doing, who doesn't. Word of mouth can be helpful, but what other criteria would you use to pick an independent shop out there to get your vehicle serviced?
Sure. Word of mouth is gold to get started. Just a huge factor too is just simply rapport. I mean, someone that you can talk to. Very rarely does anybody say I'm an expert on everything and every vehicle. I'm certainly not. I've got much more experience in some areas than others. And, given you're probably not going to go to a shop and say, what do you work on, and then go buy that vehicle. You have the vehicle you have. So, you want to have a conversation about, your vehicle and how familiar they are with that make and what their experiences is, what their certifications are, what their training is. Those things may not mean much to you in terms of what their answers are, but sometimes you don't even have to answer those questions. People that have a lot of training usually are pretty proud of it, display their certifications, their master certifications, various types of training. And most guys that work in independent shops have come up through the industry and have worked in other places, probably worked in a dealership somewhere, and have more specialty in a given manufacturer than another. So word of mouth to start with, find out where people go. And I would go visit that shop, see if you just have a conversation, talk to them about maintenance, what they might propose you do. I'm a big advocate for not overselling maintenance. It's one of the most, controversial things in our business, whether you just stick with the manufacturer's minimal maintenance schedule, or whether you do a bit more than that, and just where you fall on that. But where the shop that you go to falls on that's really important too. I don't know how else to say this, but just put it straight out there. There are shops that are, basically connected to chemical sales companies that bring in, give them free equipment, and, you know, want to flush every fluid every year, you know, are just too aggressive on the maintenance schedules. And so, you know, if you go to a place and they're saying that these are the recommendations, it's probably not a place that I'm going to be taking my vehicle or be recommending other people take a vehicle. But you know, if you can talk to them and they seem to use those same values, that they respect the manufacturer's recommendations, have good explanations for when they depart from that and why they think that's a good idea, and you just, you know, that is what I would find most important. Some place you can build a rapport with, some place that's willing to listen to you a little bit and give good explanations of why they think any given recommendation is important.
Yeah, I think that's good advice. Rick, good luck. Thank you for calling. Tom in Madison, your turn. Hi, Tom.
Hey, really enjoying the show. When I heard that lady talking about weather checking on tires, it really hit a nerve with me today, because I've never had trouble with my car or my van, but boat trailers. I bought a boat a couple years ago, and I was looking at the tread of the tire, and it looked like, you know, it had a couple seasons on it. But when you look at the sidewall, the weather checking was terrible. So I looked up the tire, and it was about 12, 13 years old. And the weather checking was really doing a job on it.
Yeah.
Yep, that is what's going to happen. You know, it's something to consider. You know, a boat, especially in Wisconsin, is a seasonal thing. You're not using it all year. And I don't know where your boat's stored. It might very well be stored inside, but for a lot of people, it's not. It's stored outside. And one of the things you'll notice on motorhomes and travel trailers a lot, when they're being park season, they've got tire covers on them. They've got these canvas covers to go over the tires to protect them from the sun. So, you know, I would certainly say that your boat trailer tires need to be replaced. But when you do the replacement, if your boat is stored outside throughout the year when it's not in use, I would consider getting some kind of cover for those tires to help protect them. And just, you know, make sure that you at least get, you know, the good 5 or 6 years that you'd expect out of them. At 12, 13 years, yeah, these are definitely due to be replaced.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you for calling. James in Marinette, we go to you. Hi, James.
Hey, how you doing, guys?
Good. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
Thanks. I have a 2010 Dodge Journey, and the last couple of years through the wintertime, the heat coming out of the vents has been getting a little cooler and cooler. I have flushed the cooling system. I flushed the heater core. And this coming up this winter here, my wife is saying that the driver's side is getting a little warm, but the passenger side is kind of cool. And I don't know what next step I need to take to get that addressed and checked out before winter here.
Well, you know, starting with the basics, you know, you maintenance-wise, you did the basic things you want to make sure do to make sure that there's flow of that warm antifreeze from the engine through the engine and to the heater core in the dash that gives you heat. But one of the questions maybe is the engine getting up to operating temperature. You know, your temperature gauge should typically read right in the middle. Even if it does, there's some tests that could be done. You know, typically, you can hook a computer up that will give a second opinion, basically, of if it is a second sensor that's going to tell whether your gauge is right, too. So that's something else that's fairly easy to confirm if the engine's really getting up to temperature. If it is, at this point, I'm starting to wonder, you know, if you're getting heat out by the driver's side but not the passenger, you know, one of the not uncommon things that we see in Wisconsin is rodent mouse, in particular nests and mouse nesting material inside those heater systems. And they can, you know, they can block ductwork so that you're not getting heat out everywhere that you should. So that would be something else that, yeah, unfortunately, it's a little bit involved to start taking some of that ductwork apart, but that is something else I would take a look at. If you're getting good airflow, that may not, you know, that may indicate that that's not the problem. But if you feel on that side, you know, you said it's cool, that sounds to me like there is airflow, but that doesn't always mean that there is. You know, the fact that there isn't heat may mean that there's not airflow. And otherwise, the other things that go wrong is in those heater systems, that it isn't just open ductwork. There are blend doors and various doors that need to open and close, and those also at times can become sticky, and they've got various felt foam around them. They're supposed to help seal when they close. Sometimes that comes loose and can interfere with the door opening and closing. So those are some of the kind of things that we'd inspect to try to get to the bottom of something like that.
James, good luck. Thank you. Tom in Buffalo County, your turn. Hi, Tom.
Yes, hello, and thanks for being there, Guy. I really appreciate you. A bad belt on a tire. Symptom I have is that the vibration at about 35 miles an hour up to about 45 miles an hour goes away, comes back again at 55 miles an hour, and I've been told it's a bad belt. Okay, I've tried three different tires, still get the vibration. Rotate the tire front to rear, still get the vibration. Bought a used wheel, put it on and change that, still get the vibration. I'm going nuts with this thing.
Yeah.
Where do you feel the vibration, Tom? Do you feel the steering wheel?
Well, if I move the tire to the front, it's in the steering wheel. Otherwise, I put the tire in the back, it's in the off the back. You feel it more in your butt, you know?
Well, that does sound like a tire. I mean, that's what you'd expect.
Yeah.
But you've maybe I misunderstood it. I thought you said you'd tried a different tire?
Yes. And I get the same thing. I've had the tire, you know, spin balanced. The guys took a look at the tire. Hey, there's nothing wrong with the wheel. So I even bought a used wheel and put a tire on that. Still does it. And I can't find it.
Yeah, you're doing all the things that we typically would do. I mean, you know, one of the advantages of working in a large shop is, you know, you've got access to different tires and wheels sometimes without necessarily having to sell them, just to use as a diagnostic process. And it sounds like you've done that. You know, one of the things that we used to struggle and to try to get to the bottom of problems like this, and there's a piece of equipment called a road force balancer that it will balance a tire, but it does far more than balancing the tire. It puts force against the tire and actually measures and can tell you, because you may have more than one tire. You may have got another tire that's got an issue, although that sounds like too much of a coincidence. But, you know, I would consider having those tires checked on a road force balancer to find out, because there's different things that can happen other than just a bad belt. That's kind of a generic description of things that can go on in the structure of a tire. But that, you know, given everything that you've done, that would be my next step, is to have them evaluate the road force balancer to find out if we've got something else going on with that tire, with a set of tires. But yeah, you've certainly done all the things yeah, that I would start with, but that's where I'd go next.
Tom, good luck. Thank you for calling. Rebel in Canada, your turn. Hi, thank you for calling.
Okay, I have a Honda Accent 2006, and I changed synthetic oil. And when I changed it, they recommend that I have to come after 6 months or after doing a 5,000 kilometer. And my wife barely drives the car, which sometimes it happened like in 6 months, she just drove it like maybe 1,500 kilometer.
Yeah.
And do I have to change it after 6 months, or I can wait till it reaches 5,000 kilometer?
You know, I normally am someone that recommends that you stick by the schedule of time or mileage, but that's such low mileage. And again, more and more people are in that circumstance that don't drive their cars as much. So, you know, it depends on a number of factors. You know, one of the things that we have in colder climates that becomes a concern when cars aren't driven a lot is that you can get more condensation that forms in the engine, and that condensation ends up as water in the oil. And that typically is something that you can see. So if you pull the dipstick out, water, because if the engine hasn't been run and you're checking it sitting cold, you pull the dipstick out because the water will, unfortunately, the oil rises to the top. The water's not going to show up there. The only way you're really going to know that is when the oil has changed, if they look at it. So, you know, the concern is getting condensation in there. And so if the car is driven every single day, but just not very far every day, that condensation is less likely than when a car sits for a week at a time and is just driven like once a week or something like that. But condensation is a concern. You know, I don't know if I was in your circumstances, I would change it as frequently as 6 months, but I wouldn't stretch it a whole lot farther than that. I understand the concern. It seems like excessive to change it much more than that with such low mileage. But, you know, you're in Canada, you're in a cold weather winter climate where that condensation is a concern. And it's just simply not easy to evaluate if there's water in there or not, although you could ask the shop that does your oil changes to take a look and see if they think there's water in it. They may be able to tell that when they drain it out.
Yeah. There you go, Robel. Thank you very much for calling. And Mary in Appleton, your turn. Hi, Mary.
Well, hello, Larry. Thank you so much for your show. I have two questions. My brakes were replaced recently, and since then, but I've been noticing for a while that it's like an, you know, it's not an even braking. So I'm wondering, is that my rotors? And then is that an easy thing that I that can change because I had a family do my brakes? And then the other question is, how important is it to, like, change my fluids at the 125,000-mile maintenance check?
Okay, well, in regard to the brakes, when you say it's not smooth, does that specifically mean that you're getting a pulsation in the brake pedal as you're braking? Like a thump-thump?
Not like, it's not like ABS. It's not that. It's like, it's just not an even, you know, and it doesn't happen all the time, but most of the time it kind of depends upon how hard I'm braking. So I'm assuming it's my rotors need replacing. And why would they need replacing? It's a 2016 Honda Accord, you know, 129,000 miles.
Well, you know, the symptom that you're describing, it's something that can happen. I mean, in a just from short term, I've seen situations where someone's parked their car at an airport for a week, gone on vacation, come back, and they had that sensation in the brake pedal. That was caused by oxidation, rust that built up everywhere on that brake rotor except where the pad sat, and that was a low spot. And that would resolve itself by driving the car, you know, a couple more weeks, and that would simply go away. Sometimes, though, the brake rotor itself will develop a warp to it, where it just isn't flat anymore. It's got what's called runout. There's no such thing as a perfectly flat brake rotor. There are tools that are kind of a dial indicator that you put on the rotor to spin it and find out how much variation there is. And obviously, over a certain point, you can feel that variation. And that can happen for a number of reasons. You know, if you, because we live in the climate with salt, causes rust, brakes can start to hang up, causing too much heat. You know, even when you're not braking, your brakes are always touching, creating some heat all the time. If there's a little bit too much drag and a little bit too much heat, that can cause the rotors to warp. You know, so that basically, the it does sound like you probably have a brake rotor issue. Brake rotors don't always necessarily have to be replaced. Although on that vehicle, I think it is what's called a vented rotor, which certain brake rotors can be resurfaced. They can be machined. They can be taken off and put on a lathe and have, you know, a thousandth or a couple thousandth of an inch cut off of it and have a nice flat surface again. Vented rotors don't have as much thickness, and I think that car does have vented rotors, not positive. But it does sound like a brake rotor issue, and again, the reasons that it may be warped or have high spots sometimes can be related to rust. It sometimes is related to just heat that caused the rotor itself to warp. So there's some possibilities here in terms of repair that maybe they can be resurfaced, but you know, they very well may have to be replaced. And if they are, you know, one of the things that's typically done on a brake job, just besides simply replacing the brake pads, is that caliper pins, the things that allow the brakes to move in and out as they're applied and released, are lubed up and have some service done on them as well to help prevent some of that heat buildup. So, you know, I don't know who in your family or how much experience they have. It's one thing to just do a brake pad swap. It's another thing to do a brake job and properly go through all the components and lube everything up to prevent that kind of thing from happening. So, you know, you need a little further evaluation to find out, you know, what can be done with the rotors if they have to be replaced, have to be resurfaced. But I would also encourage you to have the rest of the brake caliper components evaluated to make sure that you're not going to replace these rotors and 6 months or a year down the road have a problem again.
And what about changing the fluids at 125K?
Yep. If the manufacturer recommends changing those fluids at 125K, I would recommend doing that. It isn't necessarily that, you know, if you don't change them all by 126,000 miles, that you're going to have a breakdown. And some of those replacements can be fairly expensive. So, you know, I would kind of prioritize, in my opinion, you know, the highest priority typically is antifreeze and then transmission fluid. The things I worry less about are things like brake fluid, you know, steering fluids or any of the other fluids on the car are a little less of a concern. So it isn't like, you know, if the manufacturer says you have to do it 125,000, it isn't like you have to get them all in there and get them done all at once right at that time. But, you know, I would pick them off and put them in that order of priority and get them done as you can over the course of the next 5-10,000 miles.
Yeah. And Perry in Oconto, it's your turn. Hi, Perry.
Yes. I have a comment. Now that we're talking about brake rotors, I actually got a question about that. But my comment is the concern about warming up your car in the winter. I usually just jump in the car, start it, and usually take off. And I'm driving slowly until the car starts to warm up. I've heard that that's the best way. Your engine isn't running richer. You waste less fuel. And we're not made of sugar candy here in Wisconsin, so we should take a little bit of heat. But heated seats would help those people that need the warm-up. My question, though, about the brake rotors is I have a 05 RAV. It kind of eats brakes and rotors. The last rotor on the rear, it ate right through and it came completely off. Any thoughts about that model year and brakes and rotors?
Yep, that design of brake, there's different types of the brake caliper is the device that applies your brake pads and releases them as you go, and the caliper has got a number of different components. Some vehicles have more problems with those than others, and those vehicles, and this RAV is one of them, where it becomes really critical that all those pins are taken apart, lubed up, and you know, looked at to make sure that, you know, lubing it up may not be enough. The pin may be all rust pitted, and simply lubing it up isn't, you know, it may have to have the pin replaced. But yeah, again, when it comes to a routine brake job, the first, you know, a lot of times people just do what we used to call it a pad slap, just replace the brake linings and not look at or do anything with any of the rest of it. But, you know, it is very important that the rest of those components are looked at, because it's nothing more frustrating than doing what you thought was a brake job to find out 6 months to a year later that you need it again because some components weren't addressed. So, in my opinion, that's where you need to look, is at the brake caliper components. And in regard to your first comments, I absolutely agree with you, Perry, that the engineers that design the cars do too, that just to get in and drive it is the best for the car, though it may be a little bit cold.
Yeah. And on that cold note, or warm note, we're out of time. Jim, thank you so much.
Certainly.
It's been always a pleasure. I'm sorry we didn't get to everybody, but that's kind of the way it works. And I hope you'll be back again.
Absolutely. Look forward to it, Larry.
All right. Jim Ward, retired service manager of Smart Motors Toyota of Madison. Lots of years of experience, and it's always great to have him come by and talk with us. Well, we're going to switch from being on the ground to going up in the air, and we'll talk about how you might become a pilot. That's next. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along here on WPR News. Our next guest just landed, essentially, at the studio, literally. Larry Mueller here, and we have a couple of guests for you to tell us about learning to fly an airplane. One of them is Kyle Caleby, who is founder of Windborne Flight School in Racine and a flight instructor. And Kyle, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having us in.
And Tom, I hope you're hearing or have some sound coming through your headphones. Are you? No,
I don't think so.
Oh, we're hearing you. We'll get that fixed here in just a minute. Tom Cox is the other guest. Tom is a student at Windborne Flight School, and he earned an advanced flight certification in addition to his standard flying license. So, both with us, and while we get Tom's sound fixed here, we'll talk to Kyle for a minute. How was the flight?
Oh, the weather's beautiful today. Very clear, no turbulence. Straight shot from Milwaukee up to here. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, okay. And tell us then a little more about the Windborne Flight School. What do students there learn about aviation?
So it's the earliest part of flight instruction. I kind of think of it as the primary or elementary school of flight A lot of students call in thinking, or prospective students, they call in thinking that I can work with them for a few months and send them to the airlines, but it's not like that. I do about the first 250 to 300 hours in the first three certificates.
Okay, yeah. So 300 hours.
About, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So the first certificate, what's the first certificate?
Yeah, that's called a private pilot. And what that allows you to do is to conduct and plan your own flights in fair weather. So yeah. You have to be able to completely see out the window. And there's weather minimums for that. And I'm not going to get into like the technical numbers or anything like that. But yeah. Basically, it has to be fair weather. Yeah.
Okay. And the second?
And this is the one that Tom just did. Okay. So that's going to be the instrument rating. And so now Tom can fly through poor visibility weather. And we practice that and we go through all the regulations. Essentially, what you do is you are required to talk to air traffic control the whole time because you can't see where you're going and you can't to avoid other planes and stuff like that. And you learn all the rules and practice doing that, which, yeah, obviously not seeing out the window. You don't know where you're going. You feel like you're tumbling over and over, things like that. So you get used to zeroing in on the instruments so that you can conduct those flights competently. Yeah.
So that's the second. And the third is?
Commercial. So that's 250 hours. Then you can take the commercial rating. And that allows you, that makes you hireable for things like skydiving and map surveying and anything in a small airplane as you build hours to airlines. Yeah.
I had a friend who took the flight lessons and then got really interested in the planes themselves. And Keith Swalheim was his name. And he got into restoring older planes and really found a lot of joy in that. Do you ever have anybody get that far or into that?
Tom probably knows more about that kind of stuff than I do.
Yeah. So I own a couple airplanes.
Oh, you do?
Yes. One's called a Comp Air 6. The other is a Quickie Q2. Both experimental airplanes built at home. The one was built at the kit manufacturer in Florida. But anyway, I've purchased them and gone through, done some updating and upgrades and avionics work in them. And
It's very cool. Why did you decide to learn how to fly?
So from a young age, all I can remember wanting to be was a pilot. I was dead set on that's what I was going to do. My grandfather was a pilot. And I did get my private pilot's license when I was 18 or 19. But at the time in the early 2000s was not a great time to get into aviation as a career path. The airlines and the very top jobs paid great, but the middle line jobs and the regionals were terrible. That's all changed now. They're much better paying stuff now, but that's how I got into wanting to fly.
Wow. So you must, I want to go back to Kyle for a minute.
Yeah.
Because your flight school must have to work with, what is it, Racine's International, Baton International Airport?
Yeah, so it's the Racine Airport. That's a little bit grandiose of a name because they have customs for a few of like the business jets that come in and out of there. And that's why it's international. It's usually pretty sleepy though, but the plus side of that is that the runways are really big and it's a great place to train.
Yeah. It makes a lot of sense. How many students might you work with over the course of time?
So I opened in April. I've passed two students, including Tom, through IFR. And then I've been training maybe another 8, 9, 10, about that. Yeah.
It's really, really cool. What are some good memories you've had of while flying? I'm going to ask you both that question.
So right after I got my license and then I bought a plane about a year later, just getting into these small airports in Wisconsin and places that I never would have gone, although Verona is not that small, right? I know it's near here. That's why I bring it up. They have this grass runway really close to a barn, and it's in the middle of trees. So when you take off, you have to take off perfectly. Otherwise, you can't clear the trees because it's still only like, I don't know, 1,800 feet or 1,900. I think they're going to close it soon, but it's a Verona airport. I went there just to pick up something from friends in Verona, but they have the stamp system where you go there and you get your aviation stamp or passport stamp, or and I think the Department of Transportation does it or something like that. But and then people will go around and it'll give people a reason to explore all these little airports and towns that they normally wouldn't. The reason I bring that up is because it forced me to deal with that situation, that runway.
Yeah.
And it's not paved. It's a grass runway as well. Yeah. And yet it's just, it puts you on your toes to do everything perfectly and put all your skills. So just things like that where I had to use all of my skills to do it safely and competently and actually see some part of Wisconsin that I hadn't seen before.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Tom, turn to you.
Really, flying's been great. My wife and I go on a lot of little trips, and it just opens the doors up to where we can go and where we can get to in a weekend, or things, you know, that go visit friends. And with a airlines, you're stuck going to large airports, you know, mm-hmm. then possibly hours of commuting. But there's an airport, small little airport nearby almost everybody. It's really, really opens up the door to exploring a lot of off the path stuff.
Yeah, it's I have no idea how many small airports there are in the state.
So Wisconsin has 124 public use airports and many, many more privately owned airports on top of that.
So you can get you're going to get anywhere in the state.
Yeah, it's you're getting close to wherever you want to go. There's something that's not far away.
I know we were one time going up to the Bayfield area, and Keith, flew us up there and landed. There's an airport by the town of Barnes, landed up there, and it was really a lot of fun to go in and out of that small airport and then come back to Madison. And the Madison airport, obviously it's a bigger airport, but there's a separate airport or a separate spot, I think, for private planes to come in.
Yeah, I think that's what we use today.
We're talking today with Kyle Calaby, who is the founder of Windborne Flight School in Racine, and with Tom Cox. Tom's a student at Windborne Flight School. He's earned an advanced flight certification in addition to his standard flying license. Have you ever thought about flying? Questions about the coursework or the things you have to go through, I'd love to hear from you. The number to call, 800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us, the email address, talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. We're taking a look at flying on the show right now, and maybe a little bit about how to become a pilot. You can, it's possible to do it here in Wisconsin. You talk to Kyle Calaby, for one. He's the founder of Windborne Flight School in Racine. Tom Cox is one of the students at Windborne Flight School and has an advanced flight certification in addition to his standard flying license. We'll take your calls at 800-642-1234 or email to talk@WPR.org. Let's take a call from Kevin in Deerfield. Kevin, hi. Thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, I'm actually a neighbor to where Keith Swalheim kept his planes, and he had an airstrip there. And I have wondered, what is required to to have an airstrip somewhere, like if you have farmland or private property, do you know if anybody can just have a plane on their property and have an airstrip that you can fly in and out of, or what is required?
Yeah, interesting. Tom?
Yeah, there's going to be no requirements on being able to fly in and out of your property unless you have local ordinances that prevent it. So if you could bring a plane in and land it on your own property, go ahead, you could do it.
So you just need to check with local government, I assume.
This would be your local government, yes.
All right, there you go. Thank you so much, Kevin, for that question. Appreciate it very much, and glad to know you were a neighbor to my friend. Appreciate it very much. Well, the different kind there. So the beyond the three that you deal with, Kyle, are there you need more for?
Yeah, so there's getting multi-engine, for instance, right, or a lot of other specializations. So being able to fly planes with more than one engine, all the complications involved in that. But then, yeah, ultimately, if someone is doing it for a career where they need the airline license, that one can be worked on once you reach 1,500 hours. So after me, they go and do those small airplane jobs and build up to that time.
So it's a question really then of building up time in the air.
Yeah, for people who want to go to airlines, yeah.
Yeah, for people who want to go to airlines. Or what about, I suppose the same would be, I also know somebody who actually retired not long ago, flew for UPS.
Oh, yeah, yep, yep.
Would that be a similar requirement?
Well, those are going to be cargo planes, but yeah, they're certainly heavy enough to require that the people flying them would have the airline license. Yes, yeah.
And that's called an ATP, airline transport pilot.
Airline transport pilot. Well, I think he did fairly, he did fairly well. He was kind of happy with his job, that's for sure. I know he liked doing the work, for sure. Helen in Appleton, it's your turn. Hi, Helen.
Hi, I'm wondering if the instructor and student can give some insight into how you would calm someone of their fears of flying in the first place. I miss out on some of the beauty of travel just because I am just so fearful of flying.
Oh,
I have an idea. When I was first learning, and this was in my first 10 hours or something like that, especially in a climb where you can't see the horizon out the front window when you're kind of pointed upward a little bit, I felt like I was in this sort of tumbling backwards feeling. What my instructor did was set up a perfect climbing turn so that we leveled out and we had this amazing view of Milwaukee with the lakefront and all that stuff. And that was a moment where it's like, hey, I can do this climbing turn and, oh, everything on the ground is still there. The reason I say all this is because most flight schools will have what's called a discovery flight, where because all of the forces and things that you feel in the small plane are more exaggerated and you can see out the front window to see where you're going, that might be one way to, create an experience like that that makes someone more comfortable. Yeah.
Yeah, and just the general fear of getting on an airplane to fly from, I don't know, Madison to Florida or something. Do you ever have people ask you about that? How do I just get over this whole business about it?
Not a whole lot, but the thing is, with the airlines have shown to be the absolute safest form of transportation there is. If you look statistics wise, you're more likely to get struck by lightning than you are to be in a aircraft accident at the airlines.
You know, something else is turbulence is always really scary because as you start to bump around, you get that feeling like the plane is falling out of the air. Turbulence is annoying, but it's not unsafe. Unless it's, in a hurricane or something. But yeah, it's annoying, but it's not unsafe. Yeah.
So how do pilot license vary? Tom, what are you qualified to fly for versus somebody who might have gone the third section?
So I have a private pilot's license and I have an instrument rating. So I'm right now, I don't have a commercial license, so I'm just not allowed to fly for hire. Someone can't pay me to do something to fly. So the next one would be commercial, and someone I could then take jobs flying. I still can't just take my own airplane and offer to transport people around with it. There's some still more regulations from the FAA involved with that, but someone could pay me to fly other planes for them and other situations.
What's the first thing you learn or you teach, Kyle, when somebody comes in and says, okay, I want to fly?
All right. Well, this is the discovery flight. We show them the pre-flight on the ground. But the biggest thing in the air is that they can do everything on a basic flight except for landing. So I can show them how to take off. And then we talk about the four basics is the big first thing, which is climbs, straight and level flight, turns, and descents. And then we teach them how to do that looking out the windows without focusing on the instruments because we want them to get a visual reference for, you know, how the mechanics of the airplane work. So four basics is my answer. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. And as I was thinking back to another friend, this goes back a ways, but when I forget what stage he was in, but for that stage, he had to do a complete instrument landing. He couldn't see. He was essentially, I don't know if they put a hood over him or blind.
I feel like that's what you just did.
Yes. Yeah. So I just got my instrument rating, and that is to where you can fly with zero outside reference at all. And when you're in a cloud, you can't tell which way is up, down, left, right. You have to solely just rely on the airplane's instruments. And our balance comes from our inner ear. Our inner ear gets kind of messed up when you doesn't have reference to horizon and everything else. People have put planes in, and you could be in a turn and it feels like you're straight and level, or straight and level and it feels like you're turning, and you have to kind of block out what your body's telling you, because your body is giving you bad information, and you have to just go off of just the instruments, even though it feels like you're doing something completely different than what's going on.
So what's the hardest part? What was the hardest thing that you had to learn, Tom?
The hardest, I don't know what exactly was the hardest. I guess getting into where, just knowing a lot of the rules, regulations, getting into the bookwork type stuff is the hardest to me. Flying came very easy to me. Now, and that's not the same as other people. Other people have, you know, can read the book and no problem, but they have problems with the finesse on landing and stuff like that. So it's kind of, each person has their individual little challenges and stuff, and it kind of varies person to person, but that's where some of the smaller flight schools tailor to individual learning a lot better.
Yeah. Dan emailed us, it seems like the use of helicopters for transporting medical patients is becoming more popular, and certainly we see that in Madison with the University Health, a lot of transport going that way. What training, Dan wants to know, what training would these pilots have to go through?
Yeah, so I don't offer this, but when people get their private license, for us it's private pilot single engine airplane land, so you can be private pilot or commercial pilot helicopter. So it's just a different flight school. To the point of hearing all of the medical helicopters, I hear them all the time when I'm talking to controllers as they transition to a hospital or something. So it's very common. It's just not as easy as an airplane to rent. So like if I were to go and get my helicopter license, again, private helicopter license, I could conduct flights, but it's not as common to find a rental. But those training opportunities are out there.
Yeah,
for sure.
Helicopters are expensive too.
Yeah, they're expensive.
If you think airplanes are expensive, helicopters are expensive.
I forget where I was. This is a long time ago, but there was a simulator for flying a helicopter, and I simulated crashing.
Everyone does that on the simulator.
many times. Is it worth it for becoming a pilot? Is a simulator a good thing?
Yeah, so there's regulations around that too, especially for instrument training. You can do a good amount of your instrument training for your instrument license on a simulator. It has to be approved, and that also makes them super expensive because the manufacturer had to go through that approval process. So it's not just like you can go on your computer at home, fire up the at-home simulator and log that. But if it's...
You can't log it, but at-home simulators have gotten really good.
That's
and
true.
There's a lot of things you can learn at an at-home simulator as well, or just especially on just kind of some of the more regulations, or just to stay proficient in some of the things and procedure-wise stuff of what to do on a simulator works very well for staying caught up on stuff.
Yeah. Greg in Madison has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Greg.
Hello, Larry. I wanted to ask your pilots about age limitations. I'm 56, and it's interesting, but I have the sense that maybe I'm a little late to the party, or, you know, you go through the process, and then you find out that you're grounded because you're too old to fly.
Oh.
So, Greg, I have student that just started who mid-50s and is learning this for just pleasure and business reasons, right? They want to buy a plane eventually. They want to be able to travel for weekend things the same way that Tom talked about before. And so, yeah, the students that I have come in kind of split between those. So 40s, 50s, 30s in a career want to do flying for pleasure. And then the other half would be the career ones, and those are much younger.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So there you go. You're not too old, Greg. Darn it.
Okay.
Thanks.
That's trying to figure out. That's what I'm trying to figure out, that I might be too old.
No, yeah, absolutely not old.
Definitely not.
A lot of people start flying at your age. It is a ton of fun. It opens up the door to do a ton of things. You might be on the back end of wanting to be able to do it as a career, yes, but absolutely not to do it for yourself.
Yeah, that's for sure. Appreciate it very much. So how much time are we talking about at these various steps? I mean, for you, Kyle, for one of your students, what are you going to tell? Okay, I want to get that first step.
For sure. And there's a difference between what the regulations say and what the average is for someone to be ready for the check ride, is what we call it at the end.
Yeah.
Where they have they go on a flight with an examiner to make sure that they know all the different things that are in the curriculum. The regulations say 40 hours. I think averages end up being, and different flight schools say different things, but I would say 60, 65, 70. I think mine was 70 when I did it. And so that's the hours that you have when you go to take that final exam.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so when you're, let's say, our previous caller, now would somebody like him come once a week, or, how do those sessions go?
So it's dependent on just money, right? Because if you have to drag it out a little bit because you're trying to make enough money to pay for it, sometimes that happens and that slows it down. But I try to say, if you do it, 2 to 3 times a week, you can get through it in maybe like 6 to 9 months, especially in Wisconsin. If you're going through the winter, there's all these days that you just can't go because, of course, that first license is fair weather only. You can find flight schools that have weekend days. I'm working on getting more instructors for the weekends. They can tailor the schedule to you and your needs. So 2-3 times a week, I would say.
And what would be sort of a ballpark cost in terms of getting that first license?
It's
going to vary.
It varies from school to school. Different planes have different quality of equipment. So at my school, I quote about $18,000 to $19,000, just for the private license.
To get the private license.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
But then you've got it.
And yeah,
you and have to keep it up, though, don't you?
Yeah, there's currency requirements. You have to do so many takeoffs and landings every I think 90 days. I don't know if there's any – what other currency requirements. Every 2 years, you have to be reviewed by a flight instructor to make sure that you still have the basic skills.
But then but you'd want to do that anyway.
Yeah, for sure.
That's why you're getting it in the first place.
Yep. And like I said, difference between regulations and what's safe and what's recommended. But yeah.
And if you fly more often, you could progress quicker too. If you're only flying once a week, you're going to end up requiring more total hours.
Yeah.
Than someone who's really flying often and flying a lot. They keep those skills sharp, and it's easier to kind of progress your skills quickly than if you're flying a lot. So, and then also studying at home, knowing, going through doing your groundwork and stuff. There's all kinds of apps, computer programs, stuff online that you could do all of this before you take your first lesson. You will progress much faster if you get to have the stuff done ahead of time, to where it's easier to learn because you might have seen it versus the first few lessons. There's so much information to
take
in that it's like drinking out of a fire hose, and you're only going to catch a little bit. You're not going to catch all of it.
And here we are out of time. I'm sorry we didn't get to Bob in Cambridge had a float plane question, but we don't have time for that. Kyle Calabi, I should say, founder of Windborne Flight School. Take a look at his website, Windborne Flight School in Racine. Tom Cox, one of his students. It's great to have them with us today. And thank you for listening. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR.